We'll get started.
My name's Jennifer Cook. I'm co-director of the Africa program here at CSIS. My role right now is simply to welcome you to CSIS and to thank our partner, the Council on Foreign Relations, for co-hosting this event with us. CFR has been a terrific partner, and particularly Princeton Lyman, who I think most of you know, a senior adjunct fellow, I think is his current title at CFR, has been a great friend of the CSIS Africa program. Former ambassador to Nigeria, to South Africa, former assistant secretary of state for international organizations, and a long career in the Foreign Service. One of Washington's, I think, most thoughtful analysts on African issues today. So Princeton will introduce our guest of honor, Ms. Obi Ikwezili, and we will then move quickly to the panel and turn over for question and answers. But Princeton, would you like to introduce our guest?
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and thanks to CSIS, to Steve Morrison, to Jennifer, who is such a terrific leader in the Africa program. And we're very proud at the Council on Foreign Relations to be co-hosting this event. We have for some time, a number of us, been extremely impressed with our honoree and speaker, Obi Ezekwesili. And this, what we decided that we weren't just going to have her and just going to have her speak and just honor. We're going to have a panel discussion as well. So it's even more substantive because she is so substantive. She is a terrific person, and it's a great pleasure and honor for me to introduce her. As many of you know, she is now the Vice President for Africa Region at the World Bank, a great, great appointment, and one that has a lot of people very excited. Many of us know her well, very well, from her leadership in Nigeria as the Minister of Solid Minerals, but even more as her leadership of the Nigerian Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. Nigeria was one of the first countries to sign on to that initiative, and under Madam Ezekwesili's leadership, carried out a full and complete audit of the entire petroleum sector and put it all on the web. And I think it's an extraordinary achievement, and it stands as a kind of a model to others who want to move in the direction of greater transparency in the extractive industries. But she has been a leader in Nigeria on a number of measures to improve procurement, to improve investment. She is one of the founders of Transparency International, so it shouldn't be so surprised that she has worked so hard on that. Her final position before she left Nigeria was at the Ministry of, she was the Minister of Education. She already started public-private partnerships and a number of initiatives there before being snagged by the World Bank to come to Washington. Those of us who have had the pleasure of watching her work over many years and seeing the courage that she had in taking on really some very difficult entrenched interests, tackling some of the most difficult problems that one could imagine in taking on the transparency of the oil sector in Nigeria and all the things related to it. She did it with great courage, she did it with great integrity, and she earned the admiration of Nigerians and the international community. We are very, very delighted to have her with us today to speak to us and for us to honor her. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Obi Ezekwesili.
Princeton, I really want to say thank you very much for your very generous introduction. And I do want to say thank you to CSIS as well as the Council on Foreign Relations for the opportunity of this gathering. I'm, of course, very pleased that on a cold afternoon like this in Washington, anything could propel you in this kind of crowd to turn out for this event. I do want to tell you that if you came because I was oversold to you as having something substantive that you're going to learn from, then your disappointment, please register it, not on any of them, register it on me, okay? But let me start by saying that in my current dispensation, sometimes I say to myself, would you have thought you would be working for the World Bank? And I know that I had taken a bet with a friend of mine before that I would never work for the World Bank. And so she won the bet when eventually Paul Wolfowitz, who happens to also be here today, was able to persuade me to definitely sign on to working at the bank. And that's not because I did not think highly of the bank, but mostly because as someone who's ever so interested in how we can speedily find the solutions to problems, I've always looked at very bureaucratic institutions and found myself not to be very well constructed to organize my kind of work around them. But the excellent thing that I see is that there is that sense of urgency in the minds of even such institutions today, because the truth is that the world around us all is changing. And so no institution can afford to remain in a particular kind of mold. And so that's helping me seriously in my new position. I am indeed honored, as I said, to be here to discuss some of the issues that I see that catch our attention and excite our interest going on in the continent of Africa today. The Africa that a lot of people still continue to hold in their imagination is the Africa that is reminiscent of the many decades of poor governance and conflict and pernicious poverty. And so in a lot of ways, when a discussion on Africa starts, people would like you to please not tell them any cheerful stories about Africa. Please live up to my billing and tell me that nothing has changed in Africa, and that the same Africa that I saw on television a decade ago remains the Africa that I should be seeing today. Unfortunately, that is not the case. However, there is a caveat because of the recent happenings in Kenya that made people to get almost like a deja vu, and that I consider not to be typical of the new Africa that I increasingly attune my mind to in the work that I do, and in the fact that I also am an African. Africa has in recent times been witnessing higher economic growth, and oftentimes people assume that it is solely accounted for by the boom in minerals and oil revenues. And that is only a part of the story, because Africa has indeed been growing, and in a taxonomy of the countries that we did recently, we found that there are some 17 countries that account for about one-third of Africa's population where the growth rate is not happening because of oil boom or minerals boom, but because these are countries that have, in the last decade, applied themselves to rigorous policy choices that have enabled them herald an era of macroeconomic stability, doing the right kinds of sector reforms that have enabled investments to happen and to be driven by the private sector. And we have seen that in these countries, lowering levels of poverty actually has happened. What we know for a truth is that the number of extremely poor people in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa that is, has actually leveled off, and that the poverty rate has declined by nearly six percentage points since 2000, and this is based on an OECD study. The average growth rate of 5.5% that we see across the continent today does not go anywhere yet when you think that countries need to grow at least 7% and above in order to begin to make a dent on poverty. So, of course, no one is going to ask you to be triumphalist about an African growth rate of 5.5%. On the other hand, someone's going to be very sensible and say to you, why don't you acknowledge that a continent that was always considered a palace basket case of lack of growth can actually follow the trend of other parts of the world, and in some cases beat other continents of the world in the recent growth rates that it's been showing. The 5.5% average growth rate is, of course, as I said, not solid enough for triumphalism. It is still subject to volatility. And it is the fact that this progress needs to be sustained that accounts for the work that the World Bank and institutions that are partners with Africa will have to continue to do with Africa. The World Bank is, of course, the leading provider of development assistance to Africa. During the 2007 fiscal year, a lending operation of about $5.7 billion, covering all sectors of infrastructure, human development, health and education, policy and institutional reforms, and other global public goods happened across the countries that we serve in the Africa region. But as I normally say, it is not the size of the portfolio, as it is the important results that's delivered as a result of that investment. And the results in terms of how many more children were guaranteed education as a result of that, how many more mothers were taken away from the debt slab because of that investment, how many more roads were available to an agrarian population to enable them integrate into the market economy as a result of that investment. So thinking in those terms have become very important for us at the World Bank. The results agenda is really at the center of the way we seek to look at the operations that we do with the continent. But, you know, when you look at Africa and you imagine that in the 70s there was a period of high minerals prices that led to major boom in revenues in the continent, and that was followed immediately by decades of bust and serious poverty challenges. It then becomes important to look at relationship with the continent and the continent's relationship with itself from the prism of how does development assistance square up to what Africa is able to generate by itself, and how important would the work that we do with the continent be reflected in that kind of conjecture. And so when we look at Africa from the Africa region at the World Bank, one very important thing that we see beyond the lending operations, because take a typical case of a country like mine, Nigeria. This is a country where today about almost $56 billion in reserves. Total ODA to Nigeria, including over 5 point something billion that makes up annual portion of the debt relief that it got of the $18 billion. The rest is just about $1.5 billion. Compare that to its own takings, and you can see that it doesn't quite square up. So the most important thing becomes how do we work with countries for better application of the benefit streams from these takings to go toward the most important issues of investment in their human capital through health and education, and providing the right kinds of environments for the entrepreneurial spirit of the citizens to emerge and to be best deployed. I want to state that one of the main issues when you begin to have this that kind of a dialogue is that people quickly would say, we have to tell Africa how to try and manage its resources better. And I say, you know, the good thing that I'm seeing more and more from across the continent is that you don't have to externally tell Africa anymore that it needs to avoid certain kinds of mistakes. The push and the pressure for governance is coming from within Africa more and more. There are patches and islands of no acknowledging of transparency and accountability. Yes, that's true. But on the aggregate, we have many more countries where the internal pressure for accountability is stronger than anything that the externals can do. And so it is understanding, therefore, that countries need to be acknowledged as being the very important parties in any move toward a different path that is key for development institutions like ourselves. One of the things that I find very pleasing is that in the early days when we started Transparency International, it used to be the case that if we sat in a room with a leader of an African country and we took up the issue of transparency and accountability, it was almost like a look of, are you saying that there's no transparency and accountability in my country? And you're shocked because you're wondering whether you belonged to two different worlds. But today, what's going on is that most of the leaders are going to be very upfront and say, my country has corruption problems, and I need support to be able to build the right institutions, to put the right procedures in place. I want to improve my ranking on the governance scale. You know, so there is this demand that's coming from within, and that is an important change that people ought to notice that was not there. And the reason it was not there was that most of the past decade, the decade of anomie, or the decades of anomie as I call them, these were seasons when the kinds of political systems did not lend themselves to what we are seeing today. And so it is important to acknowledge that you cannot deal with the continent today the way you dealt with the continent 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, because there are new streams of leadership that are basically saying, I demand that my country should have a transparent environment. And they are very quick to reminding you that transparency and accountability is a global public good, and that really it is a case of supply and demand for the proceeds of corruption, and that they want to solve the problem. They are going to be needing international friends to also help them in solving the problem. So they are saying more and more that partnership should be exactly as it rings, that is, each party respecting the other party and taking responsibility for aspects of their actions that create the mess. In the World Bank, our program is, of course, organized around the country-specific approach. And in organizing the program around that, what it enables us to do is to understanding what the challenges of the countries are and to depend on the countries to navigate us to the areas of greatest need and to work according to the priorities of the countries. And there used to be a time when the bank was very well accused of adopting a one-size-fits-all approach. It worked in X country, therefore it must willy-nilly work in your country. Well, that season is over, because countries determine in a lot of ways what it is that they want from the bank and what they don't want. As Vice President for the Africa region, my greatest joy is usually when the Minister of Finance, together with other colleagues of his, come to the meetings at the bank or when we visit countries, and they simply say to you, this we don't want, that we want from you. That is so splendid, because that's exactly the way it should be. And so we encourage more and more that idea of the countries being in the driver's seat. What we are seeing is that for a number of the countries, the MDGs, which really are the stretch goals that have been put on the table to enable the international community keep an eye on the very important social agenda that would enable Africa tackle poverty, it's going to elude the continent, except if there was a huge impetus for investing in those targets in a way that has not been what we've seen in the past couple of years. There needs to be a major, major boost for the MDGs. And that is why the bank welcomed the high-level steering committee approach that the UN Secretary General put on the table, working together with President Zolik and other colleagues in the international community. For us in the Africa region, we are very much engaged in the process of identifying where each country's gaps lie and having dialogues with the countries, because it is part of the whole argument for efficiency of investment. Which investment gives the greatest payoff on issues that have to do with education, that have to do with health, that have to do with sanitation, that have to do with maternal and child care? All of those issues are important. And which are the investments that the governments themselves were properly advised with the right policy options can actually avoid the pitfall of assuming that they have to be the ones solving the problems? How can resources be better agglomerated in order to solve problems in a unified framework that enables better payoffs? Those are challenges and issues that we continue to deal with. And we don't do this in a very perfunctory manner. We have what we call with the Africa Action Plan, which basically is the instrument through which we've been able to look at the continent and the challenges that's been put on the table by our partners. And key sectors such as the issues that have to do with good governance, as I said, fundamental to any growth. Fundamental. Just so fundamental that you cannot, it's not a sufficient condition, but without it, you can't even start. And so that's key for us in the Africa Action Plan, closing the infrastructure gap. Because aside from the investment in the MDG-related sectors, the greatest issue that we hear within the continent today, amongst the countries that are growing and even those that are not yet growing, is the infrastructure gap. And a lot of the times, people think that when you talk infrastructure for Africa, you're simply focusing on the private sector. Not quite so. Some of the infrastructure go toward the opportunity for meeting the MDGs. For the fact is well known that in a lot of ways, a lack of investment in some of the rural health networks that need to be there have been because there have not been any infrastructure leading to that community to in order to attract and the kind of health personnel that would willingly be retained there and providing that services. So the time is gone when you do this period botanical separation of what is social investment and what is economic investment. And so it's important that we listen to the continent. One area, particularly for infrastructure, is energy. Energy is seen by the continent as that light that would show that they also are a good place to do business. And the reason is simple. When a recent quick survey was done of companies in Africa, what is the greatest spoiler today for you doing business in Africa? In the past, they used to say corruption, number one, corruption, number two, corruption, number three. But today, they put infrastructure first before, and then they put other transaction related challenges, and then you see corruption. So clearly there is an acknowledgement that more and more of the intense work that this institution, that is the bank, and other partners have done with the continent in the leadership, pushing forward new institutional mechanisms, having the right procedures, putting in place the right rules of the games, putting in place mechanisms that assure greater predictability, understanding that investment is skittish to the environment and that hostile environments, environments that are insidious to openness, do not attract the best kind of decisions from private sector. And what drives this even more is what I call the power of emulation that we see in the continent. In my previous job, I worked for a president, and so I used to just watch the kinds of competition that happened amongst countries, with some countries saying, if XYZ country has been praised for doing XYZ, we can do that even better, and throwing a challenge to all that be that this must happen. We see more of that happening in the continent, and it's a good thing. It is a good thing. In the past, there were not too many that formed the basis for the emulation. But more and more countries are forming the basis. Look at the simple thing of the doing business report that the bank publishes. Every time a doing business report of any year comes out, and you have two or three African countries as being top-ranking reforming countries, what normally happens is that you get calls from the minister or, in fact, the president of another country saying, next year we want to go up 5 ranks on that thing. And you say, well, you know, you've got to pay the price for it because the challenges that you need to overcome are just well written out for you, Mr. President or Minister, and they say we've committed ourselves to doing it. And often you see that it does work. And so it's important that we should look at Africa from that perspective where Africans are themselves saying, we are part of a global economy. We do not think that there is anything that keeps us far from not being partakers in that global economy and integrating into it. The problem, of course, is that the gap is huge. And so what it's going to take in order to closing up the gap is huge. It's going to take very strong partnership and committed partnership, not the hectoring kind of partnership. Because one of the things about the hectoring kind of partnership is that if you ever were the parents of teenagers, you would know exactly what I mean. the fastest way to make your teenager do what you don't want them to do is to hector them. And so it's important that as we deal with nations, we recognize this, because definitely nations have dignity, and the dignity of nations must be respected at all times. And the citizens really personify the dignity of nations. And I think it is very important for partners and institutions like us to recognize the importance of citizenship in the work that we do. How do we work more with citizens groups that have a sense that the demand for accountability is something that they will not compromise on? How do we develop instruments to enable us to work more with them, so that internally the pressure for accountability takes away the weight from the international community trying to make something happen from the outside, but with limited effect? It's going to be important for us to think through those kinds of solutions. Of course, one thing that is clear is that since more resources are needed if millions of Africans are to be pulled out of poverty, the very robust replenishment that the bank got during the IDA 15 is something that really stands Africa in good stead, because the agreement is that Africa region gets 50% of the robust IDA replenishment that we have for the IDA 15 round, which means that out of a record $41.6 billion, amounting to an increase of $9.5 billion over previous IDA 14 replenishment, it is clear that Africa, over the next 3 years, is going to see a massive improvement in the resources that we as the World Bank can provide. But it is not our IDA that makes the greatest difference. It is how we leverage our IDA to improving the opportunities that can be available to the continent. It is not just the finance, it is the knowledge. It is the knowledge in the sense that one of the major challenges that we see across the continent is what we talked about, the capable state. When you look at Africa's bureaucracy, you would find that in a period in history, the best of Africa's talent went to its public sector. And therefore, the level of competency with which the state affairs were managed was unparalleled. And then when the season of anomie set in, as I said, public sector became a place that those who were considered to be high flyers did not willingly choose to go to. And so the public sector in most of the countries of Africa is replete with what I call a lower level of knowledge than used to be the case before. How do we improve on this? How do we make it happen that the best in Africa would choose the public sector? You know, even in an environment of the market like the United States, that the private sector in the U.S. would not perform the way that it has performed in recent history of mankind if the U.S. did not have competent governments. It was true competent, and I talk about this historically, because it is true competent governments that the right policies to enable the private sector of the U.S. to become a leader amongst other countries to emerge. And so how can Africa get into competent governments, competent institutions, competent managers of the affairs of state? I recently spoke to African graduates at the Harvard Business School, And when I said to some of them that you would have to make choose because of your love for your countries to make take a life in the civil service, the whole room went quiet. Because the sheer fear of having somebody drag them into it was unbelievable. But then, the best of Africa's people cannot be in the private sector and the state is left at, you know, levels of competency that are lower than should be the case. And so how we, more and more countries are asking us to work with them in seeing how that can be solved. This is, of course, tied also to the whole issue of the brain drain. And I say it cannot continue to be brain drain. It can be brain gain. Because if we can find solutions that integrate the best of Africa's mind that voted with their feet because of economic incentives to come out, not just out of the public sector, but out of the continent completely, then we would begin to find ways of getting to solutions. Another thing that I do want to talk about is that the diaspora challenge is so huge, because when you look at the issue of health and the challenges of solving Africa's massive health problems, and you look at the fact that the personnel just don't have the incentive for staying back and being part of that solution, then we've got to really, as partners, work with Africa for finding clear solutions that would enable the continent attain the development goals that it has set. In terms of defining our partnership with Africa, nothing could have waved the signal to the continent about the desire of the World Bank to work with Africa from the perspective of Africa's definition of solutions. One of those definitions is that Africa has been saying that regional integration is an important component of the solution to the problems of Africa. And to that effect, many regional initiatives, especially through the NEPAD leadership, has been put on the table. One thing that we have found is that regional solutions are very good economic solutions. I'll tell you a typical example. A regional energy project that we're going to be, that we're doing, that we're part of, is going to lead to Mali paying 25 cents per kilowatt for energy as compared to current 25 cents per kilowatt. Now, that is a regional solution in infrastructure. Africa is putting that as an important solution. How we help to foster it, how we help to nurture it, is going to be key going forward. And to indicate clearly that we are about working with the continent to finding the solutions, President Zolik was a guest of the Africa Union. It was the first time that a World Bank president was addressing a summit of the African Union. And the receptivity was pretty good. And it's an indication that the continent looks to institutions like ours to work with them as partners going forward. The other thing I want to state, and then I will leave it there and open up and allow for the panel discussion, is that the private sector, the importance of the private sector in Africa is no longer something that you need a long lecture by the Wall Street types to an African head of state before they get it. They simply have come to the conclusion that jobs are not created by government. Jobs are created by the private sector. And so we're seeing many African countries saying our education systems are probably not updated enough to enable us produce the kinds of skills that even new operators in our markets are in need of. And so they are looking to investments in science and technology education, in technical and vocational education, in upgrading of the skills of the massive youth population. And tied to this is, of course, the challenge of what you do with this very youthful African population. It is, if you do not find an effective way of deploying their talent, they find a dysfunctional way of deploying it. And so whether it was in Liberia where we were at, you look at the young ones that have been just come out of this civil strife, we've got to have solutions. We've got to be able to understand that our definition of private sector must work from the very bottom to the top, and that it is important that we begin to look at issues of microfinance and rural finance and other kinds of instruments that enable them to unleash their entrepreneurial creativity to bear. It's going to be key going forward for the continent that the private sector definition not be until we find the mega investments, then we know that Africa is growing. No, the small businesses are going to create a lot of wealth in Africa. How we work with many of the countries to make this happen is going to be key. Agricultural productivity is at the heart of any such strategy, because with 60% still in the rural environment and depending on agriculture, we've got to take them to levels of agribusiness. And how we invest the energy and the talent toward this is going to be key going forward. That's why agri-productivity is a major priority in the work that we do with the continent in the region. Let me say in conclusion that one thing is certain. Africans recognize that they are going to have to take advantage of the opportunity that globalization offers. And that is why Africans worry about the fact that in a period when they have been sold on the beauty of globalization, those who sold globalization suddenly seem to be worried about globalization beyond the worry of the Africans. And so they worry about the protectionism that continues to go on in the world today. They're worried that at a time that Africa should be trading and be given the opportunity to trade at par, that all kinds of walls are being erected in order to prevent that from happening. They worry about continuing to be a source of raw materials, and they don't think that that is the idea. And in that regard, I have to say something that you probably were wondering, how come she didn't mention it? Africa looks at the emerging relationship that it has with China from the perspective that it wants to be able to expand its scope of opportunities. But one thing is clear. In doing that, Africa has got to be strategic. It has got to be about Africa having the right competencies, and this leads back again to the issue of the competent state that I spoke about. The competency for Africa to be able to negotiate with whatever party, no matter where that party is from, in a way that looks at its own strategic interest as being the most important thing that it seeks to serve when it sits across the table, is going to be key. How do we equip for that to happen? I think that Africa's time is now. I think that Africa has the greatest opportunity to be able to make it, but Africa will not make it until that people of Africa completely adjust themselves in the way that many of the countries that we have seen growing have done, which is to really put good governance at the center of every activity of the public sector, the private sector, the civil society, and the continent at large. I thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You know, as you were speaking, every time a question came up in my mind, you answered it. It was just a terrific thing. We're going to move straight into the panel, and I'm going to turn to my colleague, Jennifer Cook, who many of you know. CSIS program here is a very dynamic one with a major HIV-AIDS program, Gulf of Guinea reports, a number of other major studies and reports. Jennifer is really at the center of that. She has led teams. She has written. She speaks. She lectures. She analyzes. She's just a super person, and I'm going to turn it over to her to lead the panel.
Thanks, Princeton. And thanks, Madam Zikwazili, for just a wonderful and I think fundamentally optimistic vision. We're very fortunate to have you in your current position, I think. As you said, I think it's too early for triumphalism, but it's not the Africa of 10 years ago. And I think we have an excellent panel here, I think, to talk about some of those themes. I think standards for governance and accountability have changed, even if those standards are not always met. There are new standards for transparency, new international partnerships that have grown around those issues. There are innovative new ways of doing business, and we'll hear some of that. And then, if not new forces, at least stronger forces within African societies that are changing the way, as you said, we need to look. The international community needs to engage with Africa. So we have a terrific panel here. We'll keep the presentations brief so that we can reserve ample time for questions and answers. But to start, we have David Goldwin, who is president of Goldwin International Strategies, an international consulting firm. David has done all kinds of things in the energy sector, advised the World Bank on power sector reform, advised the U.S. government on wealth-sharing options in Sudan. He served as an advisor to the federal government of Nigeria on EITI, and previously was Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the Department of Energy and has a long history in the State Department and so forth. Probably his biggest accomplishment is using his persuasive powers to get Mrs. Ezekwesili here today, so we're very grateful to him on that. We'll start with David, and then we'll move to Rosalind Kanye, who is Director of the De Beers Group Public Affairs in the U.S., previously, Rosalind was an executive director of the group's sales and marketing arm. And Rosalind will be speaking, I think, looking at the De Beers model on how De Beers, which is quite innovative, and how it tries to work with countries to meet their economic, macroeconomic objectives, going beyond corporate social responsibility to kind of sustained development Rosalind has served as a corporate lawyer in the 1990s as an international environmental lawyer, engaged by a whole range of international and national organizations to advise on environmental policy and legislation. So she's had a foot in several worlds, and we're delighted to have you, Rosalind. And Akwe Amosu, another very good friend of the CSIS Africa program, is a senior policy analyst for Africa at the Open Society Institute's Washington office. Her role there is really to facilitate links between OSI's Africa-based initiatives and the international policy community in Washington, and particularly to ensure that civil society voices from Africa are fully integrated into Washington policy debates. Akwe comes to this from a long career in journalism and as a radio producer in African and African-related media, working with BBC World Service, AllAfrica.com, Financial Times, and so forth. So I'll keep the bio short, but thank you all three for being with us today. And David, we'll start with you.
Thanks, Jennifer. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to honor my good friend and mentor, Ovia Ezekwesili, Madam Due Process, and other names which she's called by others, which we can't repeat here out of fear for her power. But I think celebrating Obi is a good time to take a look at where we are on this whole reform and transparency movement, because there's been a lot of progress, but in a lot of areas there's really quite a lot of work that still needs to be done. And if I can take a moment to talk about the arc of Obi's career, it's really a lens on what counts and what doesn't in this space. You know, Obi's career, at least not at TI, but in Nigeria, started with the budget monitoring process. When governments sign contracts, does the money actually get spent? And then she moved to EITI, which was, when the money comes in, does it actually get into the budget? And then she moved to the mining sector, which is after you deal with oil and gas, does the money in the mining sector actually get in there? And what she modeled in energy and in mining is what's called EITI++ in the Cognoscenti's vernacular, which is not just looking at does the money that come in match the money the government says it has, but at the processes, the way you trade the oil, the way that you sell it, the way that you put the acreage out for lease. Do you count the amount that oil comes in with the amount that gets sold to see whether the numbers that you're counting actually match the volumes? Looking at the insides of the industry and how business gets done is how you root out corruption and how you make sure that governments don't leave money on the table. So Obi modeled that process there, and I think it's telling because she's taken that and now at the World Bank where not only is she leading on Africa, but helping guide the bank in its transparency work into providing the kind of technical assistance to countries that will help them look at these processes, because it's hard to do and it's hard to get experts who are independent to do it. But if you're not smart on the business, then you really can't do a good job on the corruption, the transparency. So Obi has done all this, which is terrific for Obi, and it's terrific for the bank, and it's been great for Nigeria so far. But for everybody else, it's kind of a model of where we need to go, but also where we're not right now. So I want to do just a quick little survey. In my view, I think what really counts in reform and transparency are four things. One is the budget side of it. Does the money end up in the country? The second is what I'd call sunshine and voice. Is anybody looking at the numbers from year to year to make sure that they're right, and do citizens have voice in the process? And third, I think in terms of processes, is anybody helping the countries who say they want to do this in a way that will be effective? And there, I think the good news is that the movement of reform and transparency has been mainstreamed significantly and is making progress. The World Bank has a trust fund and a lot of money. The IMF has a manual on fiscal responsibility. It helps finance ministries learn to be finance ministries. EITI itself is now its own institution, and it has a secretariat and has validation, which are basically rules for seeing whether governments do what they say that they're going to do, which are objectively measured. The bank has a guide for governments, and I think EITI has a guide for companies. I help Revenue Watch, with their George Soros' generous funding, give a guide for civil society. So the movement, I think, has infrastructure, and the movement is making progress. And on EITI in particular, there is big news really from Friday, which is there are now 22 candidate countries. And to be a candidate, a government, this is Obi's point about governments have to lead. Governments have to put somebody in charge, say that they're going to do this, come up with a work plan, bring in civil society to approve the work plan, and then get moving on it. They got to put themselves out on a ledge. And of the 22 countries that made the grade, and not everybody did, 14 are in Africa. Some are veterans, like Nigeria and Mauritania and Ghana and Guinea, but some are new, like Equatorial Guinea and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Madagascar, Sao Tome, and Sierra Leone. And this means that governments have stepped forward and say that they're willing to do this. And that, I think, is positive news. When you look at what governments who are already on the path to transparency are doing, there it's a little bit mixed. And Nigeria, which was the gold standard, took a pause in the transition, and is still in a bit of a pause, but is now relaunching the process. So the part about EITI Basic has been done. The part about implementing the reforms, which were talked about before, which is actually changing the systems, remains to be done. So that government commitment we still need to see and we still need to test. A lot of countries have processes in place, but they're all EITI Basic. There are not very many countries that are looking at the interstices of the business, and that's a place where leadership from the outside, leadership from the inside can take them into other places. And you have this new phenomenon, which I think is dismissed by some advocates, but is important, which is countries that are not part of EITI per se, like Algeria and Angola and Libya, are doing things which are improving transparency. They're having bid rounds for how they sell their acreage in ways where you open the envelope and see who the winner is. They have transparent criteria for who wins. They're publishing information, as Angola is, about how much they produce. If you look at the whole gamut of what you want from countries, it's not the whole ask. in the government term. But it is important progress. And so it's incumbent, I think, on governments, supporting governments, as they're called now, rather than donor governments. I think it's Obi who probably coined the term. They're supposed to be supporting, not just handing out. But need to engage and acknowledge and reward progress where it's being made to nurture all the different forms of transparency that are out there. And that's where I think when we get to the supporting government side, things are not great. On the U.S. side, as a U.S. citizen, I have to say the U.S. does some great things in this space. Millennium Challenge Corporation is terrific for the countries that make that grade. But there is, and we go to the EITI meetings, but there is no Center for Reform and Transparency in the State Department. There is no actual program for it in USAID. There's an anti-corruption program, but they're not part of this conversation, which means our money doesn't go there, our attention doesn't go there, and more importantly, our missions in country, our ambassadors in country, don't have this on their agenda. And to the extent that encouragement, not hectoring, of governments who do positive things ought to be acknowledged, it means we're not doing it. I've yet to see the press release saying to Nigeria, incredible job you did with making these movements on transparency. Incredible job you did putting this stuff on the web. For all the times we hector, where is the statement from the president? Where is the statement from the Secretary of State? So we got to step up and speak up and engage to give political support and encouragement for countries that are making progress. And so the U.S., through the good efforts of the Publish What You Pay campaign, got $3 million for the World Bank Trust Fund that the administration didn't ask for, which is a great thing because it will help the movement. But the U.S. can do more, and it's in our values, and it's in what we believe. But I think the U.S. needs to step up. And I think in other governments, too, you know, as it happens, if you're talking to friends and you're not hectoring, some countries have better relationships with other countries. So the French need to step up in Francophone countries. And the U.K. has done a great job, but since they don't own EITI anymore, they're not where they were before. So I think governments who have influence, who can be helpful, need to first speak up. But second, they need to step up. And that's where this capable government thing that Obi talked about is important. When countries start this, they need help. It's not that they so much even need the money, but they need people who are independent and expert, can help governments look at how they do business. Because one thing producing governments, whether it's mining or oil, don't want to do anymore is leave a lot of money on the table. And if the money doesn't end up in the budget, if you're getting had in your negotiations because you don't have a process that maximizes value, you're leaving money on the table. And so we can help governments help themselves, essentially by providing the expertise, which lies almost entirely in the Western world because of the way we've developed our economies. I want to say a word about civil society, where for as much as people might say governments haven't changed, there has been remarkable progress through EIT and other things in opening political space in countries. You know, Mauritania of all things, they've got cyber chat rooms, they've got experts, they pick their own representatives, wanting to do EITI to show that the country has changed, has opened political space. Equatorial Guinea made the grade. They had a stakeholders meeting observed by EITI and the World Bank and a bunch of other people. I mean, it was probably the first largest stakeholder meeting that took place in that country. EITI was the foot in the door that opened the political space. And in countries like Niger as well, you know, they have briefings and chat rooms. They're connecting experts with citizens. Progress is being made. Incremental progress? Absolutely. Have the governments changed? Absolutely not. But this is about making change, and change happens slowly. It just ought to be acknowledged. So last on lessons learned, because you can't come to CSIS without having lessons learned or policy recommendations or something. You know, I think are a couple of things. Company push in these countries can help. It's important, and if a government is predisposed to do something, having companies say we're part of the team is important, and they're doing that. NGO push is important because you can say there's a constituency for something, but government push is indispensable. You know, if you could have an OBI in every country, we would have a better world, but you don't. Nigeria doesn't even have an OBI right now. But you need to find champions inside who say, I want to do this for our own reasons, for our own political benefit, for our own economic benefit. And the role of externals from the World Bank or from the IMF or from the U.S. government is to recognize those champions and help them, not to finger point at them or to condemn them for not doing enough. So I think there's more we can do on that. We can be helpful. We can be respectful. We can be quick to deliver aid when we need it. But in the end, it all leads me back to Obi, which is it is a rare thing but increasingly less rare to find champions in country. And it is a good thing for the movement of reform and transparency that there is a person who knows what it's like to govern, who knows when things need to be changed, who knows and has the respect of African heads of government, and can tell the World Bank what to do at the same time. So it's a great thing for all of us that we have Obi where she is, and we wish you the best of luck in the days ahead. Thank you.
I've been told to be very quick, so I will. Fortunately, I do talk very quickly, so we'll get through. I do want to thank CFR and CSIS for the invitation to be part of this very august panel. And also, it's a real privilege to be here honoring Obi. She's someone I've admired for a long time. I think it's great to have a courageous African woman minister, and I say more of those. My presentation is about the role of business, the role business can play in development, and I mean this in broad development terms in Africa. I'm not going to bore you with a long rant because I think the worst thing is to bore your audience with what they do want to hear. I prefer to answer questions anyway. I'm from De Beers, and even though we've been in business for over 100 years, we've, over the last, I think, 10 years or so, gone through quite a radical transformation. Partly as a result of our own self-examination, but also as a result of transformation in the African countries in which we operate. We are primarily an African company. We operate in South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, and Tanzania, and just recently started exploring in Angola and the DRC. It's exciting for me as an African, I'm from Ghana, to be in an African company and very much involved in it when it's going through this transformation stage, particularly because it's a company that is very much now listening to what the African governments in the countries that we're working are saying and trying very hard to contribute to the broader national development goals. So on the one hand, we're trying to be what every company needs to be, that's make profit. And I always say, if we don't make profit, we're of no use to anyone. And on the other hand, we're recognizing that we are privileged to be in Africa. There's a lot of change going on in Africa. And there's something else that we possibly can contribute to, which is over and above, say, if you're in a company in the US or even Russia or somewhere in Latin America, if I dare say. I think it's been difficult for business to find its place on the broader development economics agenda. I think very much international organizations like the World Bank, civil society, and others have found it very easy to come to the table. And sometimes business has been there very much as a guest, sometimes an invited guest, sometimes it's a pushy guest. But it's always been very much on that sort of, well, what else do you have to add? And we're the ones who know best. And I think business has therefore had this fallback position of saying, well, we create jobs, very important. We pay our taxes, very important. And then sometimes, or more so now, we carry out corporate social responsibility activities, all very important. I don't presume to speak for all businesses. We are a natural resource business, so I just want to limit myself to that, and even more so to the diamond industry. But we do believe very much that in spite of all that has been written, spoken about the natural resource curse, that natural resources can be properly managed so as to provide a firm foundation for sustainable development in all of Africa's resource-rich countries, and not just the few that are constantly mentioned. I want to humbly suggest that initiatives like the EITI are very, very important, very significant. But we believe that as a company, they are part of the equation and not the whole sum. And I say this from a point of view of our experience in the African countries in which we have mining operations. And the natural resources there have driven and continue to drive sustainable national development. And the two examples I'll give are Botswana and Namibia, just to pull those out. I know Namibia is quoted very often, and everybody knows about them. And I think maybe, Botswana is quoted very often. Namibia, I think, to a lesser extent. We recognize that our ability to translate natural resources into national assets are very dependent upon an empowered and stable government. And we've heard about the transparency issues and governments being accountable. And that's very important. That's what we've seen in the countries in which we've operated in. But when we also reflect on the experiences we've had in these two in these countries, we can identify a number of other things that we believe as a company we have contributed to the growth, prosperity, and stability of those countries. And One such, I'll just give two examples because of time. One is the partnership models we have with the governments of these countries. And it's not the sort of forced, we will take 51%, you have 49%. But this is a negotiated partnership. And it doesn't just happen at the upstream level or the mining level. So in Botswana, to give an example, I don't know how many of you know that Botswana actually owns 15% of De Beers, the parent company, to start with. And then we go locally, and it has a 50% share in the mining company that is on the ground. And then, furthermore, it has a 50% share in the trading company that is in Botswana. So right throughout the pipeline that we're involved in, we have an active partner. And I'm not saying we are always the best of friends. There are its challenges. But it's a very healthy, challenging situation. It helps us mold our business model. It helps us use what we're learning in Botswana as an example for what we do in other countries. I think the other thing that we have learned very much as a company doing business in Africa is, again, actively supporting national development goals. And not just in a, yes, this sounds good, we're behind you, but really coming to grips with what exactly can we do as a company to make those development goals become a reality. And I think the best example is what we term beneficiation, which is what can be done to add value to natural resources in the countries that are producing them. Now, with De Beers, we just mine and sell rough diamonds, and that's where it begins and ends. Yes, we do have the advertising end, but that's for everyone's diamonds. We advertise everybody's diamonds, believe it or not. But so we're miners and we're sellers of rough diamonds. There's a whole list. There are other pieces along the pipeline, cutting and polishing diamonds, jewelry manufacturing, jewelry design. We're not involved actively in any of those. But we do know the countries in which we operate in really want to see these activities coming more into play in their countries. So what we've done is we've encouraged our clients to whom we sell rough diamonds to build factories and operate more in-house. So this is really a third party, and we do it at the risk of being told you're controlling somebody. We have all these antitrust issues to deal with, and it's always you're controlling someone else. But we feel that it's very important for the countries in which you operate to have these other operators. And Obi, I think, is where you talk about small businesses, because these create medium-sized businesses, which then go on to lead to small enterprises, procurement. You know, there's a real, what do you call it, roll-on, or, you know, other side effects to this, which are all very good. And we believe that this is very important, to grasp and see how best you can model your business to take into account these things. People do say to us, but it doesn't make business sense for you. Well, I think the point is that in the long term, it does. For us, as a diamond mining company, it takes about 10 years for us to get our first return on our investment. So you're in there for the long haul before you get your first penny. And then it takes 10, 20, 30, or in South Africa, 100 years. You know, you'll be there for that length of time. So the stability of the government and the stability of the people of the country, or the contentment of the people of the country, is very important for us as a business. And so doing things that may not seem to be make immediate business sense do in the long term for us make good a lot of good business sense. Now these two countries I've mentioned, and South Africa and Tanzania, have been relatively easy countries for us to operate in. We're moving into more challenging countries, Angola and DRC. And whereas in Botswana we can say, well, we pay our taxes to central government, royalties, dividends, and the government then makes sure that the rest of the country benefits from it. We can't say for sure, particularly where we have our concessions, say in Angola, where there's no infrastructure at all, that necessarily government is going to move out into those areas and build infrastructure because we're building a mine. And yet, believe it or not, De Beers isn't as rich as it used to be. So we can no longer build the roads, the hospitals, the bridges. And as you were saying, we do need partners. So it's at this time that we're going to have some scenario planning to decide, well, what exactly will be the impact of us opening mining operations in these far out places? And who do we need to get into partnership with? Who knows how to build roads better than we do, or bridges, or hospitals, or schools, and get into partnership with them in those far out areas? And again, how can we take the lessons that we've learned from the countries we're operating in at the moment and adapt those for where we're going into? It might be that with Angola, we might have to say, we pay some of our taxes central government, but we need to invest a lot in the local areas. We haven't decided that yet. These are all things we're discussing. In conclusion, I want to say we definitely don't have all the answers. This is a journey we are on. It's very much a role, a place that we'll like to have a leadership role in, and looking very much for others to join with us on this journey and find the solutions. And just one last thing, I think about money on the table. I have to say, the Botswana government is a great negotiator. Out of every dollar that we make from, or is made from diamond mining in Botswana, 82 cents of it remains in country, and I think that's a pretty good... Which doesn't make us poor, but, you know, I think it's a pretty good negotiations. Thank you.
Okay, right. Very pleased to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. And very warm congratulations, Obi. The work that you did to add transparency at federal level in Nigeria's oil sector really had a massive impact. And I think the fact that groups on the ground, including partners of OSI and Revenue Watch Institute, are trying to now move that work on to the state level says a lot about how much the work you did is continuing to inspire people on the ground. It's pretty wonderful. And I also very much appreciated Obi's comments about the importance of civil society as a driver of change. We at OSI obviously consider this to be absolutely critically important. Indeed, we'd probably say that the appearance or the emergence of civil society as a player in public life has been one of the most important transformations in Africa's political life. The Nigeria that I grew up in had very little in the way of an active civil society. The Cold War had a chilling effect on public discourse. The notion that non-state actors might do more than just make occasional criticism of government performance, might even propose policy or might agitate for change, was not welcomed in that period. Some of you might recall a novella by Kole Omotoshoy in Nigeria called The Combat, which describes how a perfectly small and innocuous event turns into a standoff comparable to the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was the atmosphere in which people tried to or imagined themselves mobilizing or being critical. And so we have really witnessed a very major transformation in the 90s and subsequently. The so-called wave of democracy, obviously at a party political level, but also a real surge in public participation. And although I don't think that's any more popular with African governments than it would have been before the Berlin Wall came down, I think nonetheless there is new space. And the contribution of programs like EITI, not only in making use of civil society involvement in its own development, but also in entrenching the idea that civil society has a critical role to play in broader aspects of governance, has been very important. You often hear a huge amount of criticism. You hear about how civil society groups are, you know, scattered in their criticisms, they're inconsistent, they're sometimes corrupt, they're too easily diverted or hijacked. They'll be accused of being donor-driven, of having too much power to influence and not being accountable enough. And particularly during the 90s, I think the accusation that they absorbed resources that would otherwise have been better invested in government. I think there was truth in those and other complaints. But we work a lot with partners in this sector, and we think that the assets that have been built in this period are striking and increasingly focused, better constituted, better managed, more internally accountable, and more mature in their judgment and their strategy. And I think you can point to multiple examples. We don't have a lot of time, and I don't want to do it for too long, but you know, I would point, for example, to the Publish What You Pay coalition. Extremely active, extremely articulate. It was important that a couple of days after the meeting in Accra that David was referring to, at which the new candidate countries were included, Publish What You Pay was there issuing its own statement talking about what it expected of those countries, but also of the countries that are already signed up and have failed to deliver. And I think without that level of pressure and critique, we would have a less helpful or less functional system working. I note that last week in Nigeria, some 70 groups came together to form something called the Movement movement against corruption in Nigeria. They set up a panel, an executive committee. They set up five different panels of experts. They've got strong leadership coming from the faith-based community, and they are going to be very critical. If you listen to the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission's leadership, they see civil society's role in monitoring and applying scrutiny and defending the project of anti-corruption work as being absolutely critical. I won't do any more examples there, but I want to talk a little bit about why I think this is so important. You've heard a lot of talk, particularly in the wake of what's happened in Kenya, of the reversal of the democratic movement or the democratic trend in Africa. We're told that Africa is slipping back, that we're seeing, you know, too many newly authoritarian administrations. Certainly on the human rights front, people have literally taken a beating, but so has the sector and advocates of human rights. You've only got to look at the lists that are circulating in Nairobi at the moment of human rights defenders who are being targeted with death threats to understand that this is not fun or easy work. But I think what I would say is the existence of these civil society organizations, this layer of non-state actors, is actually an indicator that people should take heart. This is not, in my view, a simple equation where you have a bad election or you have a repressive government in place and all of a sudden we can take that country off the list of countries that are making progress. On the contrary, quite often what it means when you see 200 people being shot in the street after an election, or you see a power grab at the last minute of what otherwise was a very effective and orderly process, is that there is a pushback going on. You've got people realizing that there is no other way to hold on to power. You wouldn't need to shoot 200 people in the street if there wasn't a real threat to the people who want to hold on to power. So although I don't say that everything is fine, what I say is that the sign of the battle or the sign of the tension is in itself a sign that there is significant capital being built up in the non-state sector and that that's going to make a big difference in the future. And I want to say something about Kenya, because as an advocate here in Washington, I've been doing a lot of work on Kenya in terms of liaising with other governments, with the US government, with the policy community here in general. And it's been a real privilege to have this close contact, particularly with this coalition we're working with, the Kenyans for Peace with Truth and Justice. 30 plus organizations focused on governance, focused on human rights, focused on a range of civil society activities, and obviously on democracy. Those groups and their leaders have shown such courage, such leadership, and such intellectual smarts. It's been quite startling. They've been in seven different international capitals. They've been in Addis Ababa. They've been working very effectively at mobilizing civil society in other countries. The messaging, if you go and look at what is on Kofi Annan's shopping list there in the Serena Hotel in Nairobi, you will find that nearly all the items that they have made progress on in those talks were on the KPTJ's list back at the beginning of January of things that they felt were critical. Everything from a TRC, from accountability for the violence that's been perpetrated, to the list of specific constitutional reforms that they believe are necessary if there is to be an exit from this crisis. So I think we can feel some confidence that there are people engaged at a very intensive level with day-to-day politics and day-to-day governance on the continent who are making a huge impact, and that that means actually that there are very good prospects for democratic advance on the continent. Despite these periodic setbacks, it seems to me that we should feel that things are in reasonable shape. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Akwe, and to all our presenters who had a lot of information in a very compressed time frame. So thank you. Why don't we take a round of questions for the panel? Yes, sir, here. We'll take a few together and then.
An assessment of the current role of the African Development Bank. What role is it playing? What could be the potential future role?
Hi, Rewa Karus from the Council on Foreign Relations. I have a question to anyone and everyone on the panel. Could you talk a little bit about how you foresee the ability of African governments to gain rapidly compliance, not just from China, but from India and Russia, in the area of transparency and the governance of natural resource-based industries. I focus a lot on transatlantic harmonization issues, US-EU and transatlantic multilateral, but I think there's a growing issue here that is broader than just the freedom of governments to negotiate strategic arrangements with other countries. There's an issue of global norms or convergence of norms that has to be addressed. And we rarely hear about the Russians in Africa, but clearly this is an issue with gas expansion. Thank you.
Let's take one, two more. Let's try to keep them brief because we are just about out of time.
I speak, I'm representing the Nigerian People's Forum and the Coalition of African Communities in the Greater Philadelphia area. And my point that I wanted to put on the table is the leadership at the country level. Where does the panel, and in particular, Madame Ezekwesili, see the relevance, the cooperation, is there any movement towards more transparent leadership? Because after all, it has to start from the top for anything to happen positively.
Thank you. And then Tony.
Yes, Madam Minister, I just returned from the mining in Daba, which you attended once in Cape Town, and during the course of the presentations, the Minister of Mines from the Democratic Republic of the Congo announced a new process of reviewing mining contracts in the Congo. What struck me about that was because surely prices have increased greatly in many of those commodities that are being mined, but the shock and response by the industry was so negative to the proposition that there might be a review of new contracts that in the course of even 24 hours, there was a $2 billion loss in mining equities in the Canadian Stock Exchange just overnight as a response to that. Should we not do a better job in both preparing industry and preparing mining ministers and governments in how to bridge that gap of expectations, both fulfilled and unfulfilled?
One last.
Imo Ibia. I do have a quick question, and anyone on the panel can take this. We've heard quite a bit about, and I really do want to applaud Dr. Ezekwesili, about some of the tremendous developments on the continent in the positive direction. But living here in the U.S., and I guess it's probably the same thing in much of the Western world, the psyche generally is that things are still extremely bad on the continent. What you hear on television, what you read on your newspapers, what you hear on radio is still very negative. In all the work that is being done by whatever group is doing it, what is being done to really impact that aspect, telling those who need or should know that things are happening on the continent. What is being done to really begin to change the mindset? I work
Thank
in
you.
Industry.
Thank you. Sorry. Okay. Good question, though. Thank you.
Quickly, the question on ADB. We actually, at the World Bank, consider the African Development Bank as a key partner institution on the continent. The ADB is the best legitimacy as a financial institution for development within the continent. In a number of our programs, we collaborate with them, in whether it's in natural resources management programs or it's in regional infrastructure programs, and also in programs that really look at the global public goods of communicable diseases and some of the aspects of what we're trying to do in regional centers of excellence. So the African Development Bank is the institution that is within the continent, understands the continent in a lot of ways, but also the ADB recognizes that the World Bank is a very important partner to it, and that the global reach that we have really will support in a lot of ways some of the things that they may not necessarily have. And so it's a partnership that lends itself to the marriage of competencies and areas of great prominence that each party may not particularly have, but which the other possesses. So it's not a rivalrous relationship. It's actually a very complementary one. And then there was the question, let me start from backward, the issue of the state of affairs and communicating it better. I think that part of the kind of what you're doing here today helps. I know that the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as the Center for Strategic Studies, is always focusing on Africa-related subject matters. It is how far that these institutions go in doing a mass dissemination of the information that's available that becomes the problem. But one thing that's clearly more apparent is that the leaders in the continent are not finding it. They find it disturbing that somehow the information networks have a focus on only the things that are negative, and that there's got to be a way that the good news that comes out of Africa is also made headline news. But as you know, it's a season of sound bites, and in a season of sound bites in the media, I think somehow it's going to take a very strategic approach at not ever tiring to communicate in order to get in it. And so one good thing that's happening is that we're seeing some media groups using the internet to great effect as a way of mass distributing good information that comes out concerning the continent. But the greatest ambassador for the continent are going to be the businesses that are doing good business on the continent. Unfortunately, they actually do the opposite. They try to make sure that competitors don't come close by telling them that, you wouldn't be able to cope. It's such a hard place out there, So that works against the continent. I'm glad you talked about, your activities on the continent. But many of the mining companies that could easily, especially the, the smaller generation companies, that could easily set up shops and be the source of greater employment opportunities in the continent as against the big mega projects, don't go near the continent just because of the spoiler information about the continent. So how can we use trade groups for the interest of the continent in communicating it better, and how can we work more with governments and with people who know the continent to communicate it? And then how rapidly can African governments gain compliance from countries like Russia and China and India? It goes back to what I said about country being in control. When I implemented the EITI++ in Nigeria, it did not matter what country you're from. For as long as you're coming into Nigeria to participate in the mineral sector, you were definitely signing on to the principles of the EITI, the NEITI. It's our national program, and so you were duty-bound to comply with it. And so when I talk about the need for helping countries to build the right kinds of capacities. And it's when I talk about the competent state, the competent institutions, the competent skills within government, it's not a joke. I know that makes the greatest difference between countries that do well and countries that don't do well in the continent. If you went into countries and you looked at sectors that are being run by competent people, you immediately see the big difference. And so the mix of competency in terms of knowledge and integrity and experience that we need in order for institutions to stand up to demanding standards of behavior without any compromise is going to be crucial. You cannot... A man or a woman cannot give what they don't have. In some of the countries, it is not because somebody has engaged in some corrupt relationship that made a particular deal to be signed. It was simply because there was a lack of knowledge behind that process. So it's key that as development partners, we look at the whole capacity discussion from a different realm and not simply see it as, you know, something we occasionally remember to do. We must build the capacity in a way that is very targeted. And then there was the question on the DRC and the reviewing of contracts and how, you know, that creates a problem for business. I have to tell you, some of the contracts that companies signed on in these countries are odious, completely indefensible. And, you know, it's so easy for some of the companies from the Western world to sometimes hold up their nose in derision against some of the things that they believe that the continent is doing with China or India or Russia. But the truth is that there were always some odious contracts from every part of the world in the continent. I think that what's important is that within the maxim of rules of what is tolerable and what is right, I think countries and their clients and should be encouraged to have the dialogue that is important. What we've, as the bank, have always done is to urge people toward that two-party dialogue toward resolving those kinds of challenges. Steve has gone, but in Liberia, they had to do a similar kind of thing with the Mittal brothers, and that's gotten them a better deal than what was signed onto. It's important that this knowledge asymmetry that worked against these countries be breached. And in a world where we're talking about this openness and this transparency of activity, it has to be that every party must be held up to that standard. It's of no benefit if we looked at the need for transparency as being that of the countries in the continent, not the companies that do business with them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.